Accession number 28698, Reel 20.
What happened next?
Well, the depot took me through then to September 1982, where I'd been earmarked to go back to my battalion. And they said to me, you're going back as a platoon commander, as a colour sergeant. And I was warned by my quartermaster at the time, only do that for 6 months, then demand promotion or demand to get off that particular appointment. Anyway, I went back to Wheaton, near Blackpool, where the battalion were stationed, although they hadn't long been back from Northern Ireland. But just a point to note, during my period at the depot, our Major General, Peter Sibbald, our Colonel Commandant of the Light Division, and a Captain Mike Livesey, who was the CO of HMS Invincible, had formed an affiliation between the Light Infantry and HMS Invincible, which, believe it or not, still remains very strong today. Anyway, Tuala had just completed another tour of South Armagh when I returned to them, and on that particular operation, the battalion had carried out some more sophisticated clearance of bombs with the help of the ammunition technical officers next to the border crossing points. And all these bombs were now getting sophisticated and remote controlled. And another was to clear a booby-trapped flagpole with an Argentinian flag on it. And that had been put there by the Provisional IRA during the Falklands crisis, which had also taken place while I was a CQMS at the depot. And they'd also had a successful time while I was away finding several bombs and loads of ammunition and loads of weapon systems. And we'd only had a couple of guys wounded on separate shooting incidents. So the guys were on a high when they came back. But the other thing that was changing in Ireland at the time, the Provisional IRA were determined to fetch a helicopter down. And Tuala had had a few attacks on their Wessex helicopter because we travelled all over in South Armagh by Wessex. And at one incident was by five Provisional IRA gunmen who tried to shoot the helicopters out the air with our soldiers on board. But no soldiers were actually lost on that particular tour, for all that had been busy. The role of 2LI by the time I got to them was also going to change as well. While the battalion had been in Wheaton, they'd been on a home defence role. We were now changing to the British Army of the Rhine reinforcement, and were warned off, and this actually did happen in January 1983. We remained as part of 42 Infantry Brigade, which we were always in, but our war role changed in support of 24 Infantry Brigade.
And were they in the British Army of the Rhine? They were over in the Rhine, were they?
No, 42 Brigade were in...
42, the other one, 20...
Yeah, 42 Infantry Brigade were in Preston, because Preston was obviously just down the road to Blackpool. But our war roof to 24 Brigade was the brigade that was in Catterick at the time. So we're administered off one, and our war roof was for the other, which wasn't too complicated for us at my level. And we also, things were changing in Civvy Street as well. People were going on strikes and one thing or another. So the whole battalion were put on Operational Keelman, which was the maintenance of essential water services in the event of strike action by the civilian water services. I'd gone back to the battalion as 2IC, the anti-tank platoon, still as a colour sergeant. And the battalion at that time had six combat 120mm guns, as we had the Wombat earlier in my life. But I was immediately sent then to Netherhaven to learn the Milan system, which was the light anti-tank guided missile system. So I spent 6 weeks down there, and on my return back, I had to start an anti-tank cadre to convert the battalion from guns to Milan posts. So we went from six guns to 24 Milan missile posts.
Can you describe those? What were they like, and how did they fire, the Milans?
The weapon system was on a tripod, and on the tripod you had a brilliant, sophisticated weapon sight, and on the side of the mount you put the missile, which was about about 4 feet long, in a tube, and when the button was pressed, the missile went forward, wire-guided with a thumb control. The tube was then ejected to the rear. And the only telltale sign was a puff of smoke on launch. But you could guide that missile with your thumb-guided joystick right to a target almost 2 kilometres away.
And how many would be a crew to one of the missiles there?
Again, it was a four-man crew, but actually three men physically on the ground. And the fourth man, just like the Wombat, was the driver who maintained the weapon system. But we'd gone up. So my platoon doubled, almost trebled in size. So I went from about 24 men up to 74 men. And it was a big change for the whole of the battalion.
Can I ask you as well the structure of the men in the platoon? Who would command a platoon of that size?
A captain. Because we were part of a support company alongside the mortars, who were commanded by a captain, the recce platoon, commanded by a captain, and the Milan platoon, commanded by a captain. But we would then have a company sergeant major in charge of us and a company commander as a major.
Would the officer have the same knowledge, expert knowledge of as you had?
He also had to go away and do a Milan course because the tactics were changing, the armoured fighting vehicle recognition of the Soviets was changing, and our own NATO forces. You had to be able to recognise all tanks of all nations. For obvious reasons, you didn't want to go blowing your own tanks up or that of your friendly forces. So he had to learn everything. And of course, the tactics, map reading, sighting of your Milan positions and everything, he had to do exactly the same course, apart from the weapon instructional part, which was the platoon sergeant's job, or the platoon 2IC's job, which I did.
Would you have fought as a platoon, or were you loaned out to in certain situations?
No, we'd put four Milan posts, or six Milan posts, to each rifle company, because we were evolving now into becoming an anti-tank battalion for a role that we'll take on a couple of years later. Also, what was evolving was the radio system. We'd had the old radio system for years and years now, and now we're going on to a system called the Klansman radio system, which was a marked improvement in communications. It was more robust and high frequency and low frequency and very high frequency. And with the necessary aerials, we could almost talk to the other end of the world with the correct sighting. So communications had also taken a leap forward at the same time in the period of that we're talking about now.
And were communications also down to almost individual level?
Not to individual level, but it was certainly down to platoon level and section level. Section commanders and section 2ICs all carried the smaller versions of the Klansman radio. So you could talk section to platoon, platoon to company, company to battalion, battalion to brigade. So the system was getting better, which meant we could have a wider view of a battlefield and still communicate with each other. Again, where we're being put on standby for the water strike or the water services strike, by April and May of 83, we're also trained as firemen for the fireman strike, and we learned how to use the old green goddesses, which is the MOD green fire engines held by the Home Office. So we had to learn how to wear that equipment, how to use the picks and the axes and the fire hydrants, how to work the Green Goddess fire brigade, fire engines themselves, and everything to do to fight the different kinds of fires, be it a gas fire, electric fire, a garage on fire, or a block of flats on fire. So we all had to learn all them drills.
And the firemen, of course, were always worried about the fact that you would, no matter what training you had, it would never really make you a fireman, for example.
You could never replace a fireman. We were there as the first immediate action to do first aid, if you want. If we could get there and put water on a fire to stop it spreading, really that was the end of our capabilities. And we were taught as such. But we were taught by the fire brigade.
Did you enjoy it? Did the troops enjoy
it? Yeah, it was exciting. We never physically took on the role. We were highly trained to, or the standard required by the Home Office in case we were going to be used, but we physically never got called out at that particular stage. Anyway, we didn't. So we'd done the training for the water service, we'd done the training for the fire services, and then we also, as a battalion, took part at Kiel de Forest as part of the Hunter Force against our own SAS, who were doing an escape and evasion exercise. Of course, we were used, like I suppose the old Germans used to track down escaped prisoners in the war, great big straight lines, beaten the bushes to find the SES, and that was quite exciting as well. It was good for the soldiers because it was a morale booster that we were chasing our own SES.
And how good were they in keeping hidden from you?
Oh, they were exceptionally good. But of course, when you've got a battalion of men out on the ground, you do catch the odd one. And they need to be caught because they then had to go into the interrogation part. So their own people needed to catch them, needed us to catch them anyway. But it was interesting there. It was an interesting concept to be in as a hunter force, looking for live soldiers, knowing that they were going to be interviewed by their own people. It was a good thing for the battalion to do. And again in May, I was part of the Light Infantry Colour Party, who we moved across to York for the inauguration parade in Imphal Barracks in York for the return of 2 Infantry Division back to the UK for the first time since before the war. They were coming home at last. And apart from 2 LI being involved, 5 and 7 LI, who were our TA battalions, were also a part of this parade. And so with another 15 or so different regiments.
Where had they been? Obviously, all over the world, I suppose. The division rather than the...
2 divisions had been in Germany before and during the war, and then after the war. But they were finally coming back home, and they were posted, or they all came back to Imphal Barracks, where they still are now, is the largest division of infantry in the UK. So it was an honour for us, in front of the Queen, to be part of the colour parade. And I've got photographs in the house to prove it. At the same time we were doing that, D Company was sent off in support of the King's Own Royal Border Regiment to the Falklands for 4 months. So off in the July, they went off to the Falklands for 4 months. So we lost them as part of the battalion. And then in August, so this was something different happening every single month here, the rest of the battalion went to Otterburn, up in Northumberland, as part of Exercise Red Grouse. And not only were we going to exercise as part of Red Grouse as a battalion, but we also, or the battalion had to, rewrite and trial a company group live fire and exercise on behalf of the UK Land Forces. So the exercise was already in existence, but it was stale. And now we're training for NBC with every weapon system going, and 2LI had been given the task to rewrite this exercise and trial it before we trialled the rest of, before we exercised the rest of the UK Land Force Army. All weapon systems were used, including artillery, mortars, my 24 Milan post, because I was still the Milan Sergeant Major at the time, the Recce Fox reconnaissance vehicles, and the United States Air Force A-10 Thunderbolt aircraft were also used on this exercise. And it was a 36-hour exercise, live firing all these systems, wearing full NBC kit.
NBC is what?
Nuclear, biological and chemical warfare suits and respirators.
Can you describe those to me?
The suit?
Yeah, can you describe that kind of clothing?
Yeah, the suit was charcoal-based in several layers, with a pair of trousers with braces on the inside that you pulled up, and a smock-type jacket with a hood on that came over the top of your body, with fasteners on the cuffs and on the base of your boots. We also had the rubber NBC boots, were a design that once fastened up with the ties, that the gas couldn't enter the boots either. And then the trousers were pulled over the top of the boots and again strapped down so nothing could get inside. The hood was always pushed back, the respirator put on with its canister. The hood was then pulled over the sides and the rims of your respirator itself, tied with a buddy-buddy system where you made sure there was no hair or anything sticking out, and believe it or not, you were then in a sealed suit and respirator that didn't let any gas in. I think it was the envy of the world, because, and still today, it's the envy of the world.
Comfortable to wear?
No, but more comfortable than the Russians, Chinese, the Americans, or anybody else's suits. It was the best there was, but depending what you'd put underneath, you would either be too hot or too cold. And of course you had a pair of cotton gloves over your hands, and then a pair of, that was to absorb sweat, and then a pair of rubber gloves over the top of that. So you lost a lot of your touch. And that's why we practice using this all the time, because your weapon felt different, your radio, when you were working on the radio and you're writing things down with your pencil, all felt different. So to get over the cumbersome use of your hands enclosed in rubber, we did several exercises to get used to wearing a respirator, because your breathing changed, your vision changed, and everything else. So it was essential that you trained on all your weapon systems using NBC suits.
And you say there was absolutely no way that a gas could have got in?
No, we used to check them by going into gas chambers or respirator chambers, where CS, you would go inside, the doors would be closed, CS gas pellets would be ignited, and you would have to stay in there to prove that your respirator and your suit was working. You soon knew if it wasn't, if you hadn't pulled your ties around your respirator correctly, and if anything got in, you knew what CS gas was all about.
And for other kinds of the biological aspect of it, that would get on your clothing more than through it, is that right?
Well, if it did, I mean, these suits were so designed with the charcoal and everything else that was impregnated into them, hopefully to stop anything that was nuclear, biological or chemical. Unless it was some kind of agent that was going to soak through the clothing, and hopefully it wouldn't get through the charcoal bases, that was our protection for nuclear, biological and chemical.
So they must have been tested, but presumably you didn't actually wear these and have this biological test on you. They didn't spray you with something else.
There was tests of porting down in places like that, where different things were obviously sprayed in the air on this clothing and all the rest of it. But we were all led to believe, and did believe for our own good anyway, that these suits would protect us.
You were very confident that this was the case.
I certainly was. I never feared that if we went in that situation, we weren't wearing the correct equipment.
Right, so what else were you doing at this time?
It was at this time I also got promoted as well, up to Warrant Officer Class 2 now. So I was a SAR Major, and I remained in charge of the Milan Platoon. My officer had gone off for a six-month stay in Australia, although he was South African himself, but he went off to Australia, so I was now in charge of the full platoon. And then in October, the battalion moved off to Kenya, and my officer had come back from his stint in Australia. And we went on Exercise Grand Prix, which was the battalion exercise in the Kenya training area, where we completed all our jungle training again in the rainforest of Kafandini, up in the bamboo area part.
What date was this?
This was in October.
What year?
1983 still. I say every month we've gone somewhere different, done something different.
Did you sail out or fly out?
We flew into Nairobi, and then we were picked up in coaches and taken to a place called Nanuki, where we're issued with all our jungle equipment, our garlic jungle knives, and all the equipment we'd need to survive in the jungle. And we were lucky, we more or less bussed and then into our own military transport into Kafandini to do our jungle training. And then after the jungle training, we went live firing at Mapala Farm, which was an area in the middle of the Kenya training area. So you fire all your weapon systems live. And the dry training areas were the place called the Dondol, which was arid and desert and scrub. And it's like you see on safari. And you saw all the animals, and you saw the giraffes and everything else moving around. The hardest thing to see was elephants. But you're forever walking in elephant dung. And you would hear the lions and everything else. R&R was taken in Lake Naivasha or Mombasa. And my platoon actually went to Mombasa, just outside one of the tourist sites. And it was absolutely brilliant. The blokes all thoroughly enjoyed Kenya.
And this jungle training was, from your own experience of past jungle training, pretty much the same.
It was the same. We'd had an advance party who went across to learn the new modern techniques of crossing rivers, cutting through jungle, but all the perimeter defences around your camp at night time, where you put your guns, where you put your sentries, that was all exactly the same. And having been jungle warfare trained myself in Malaya was an advantage to my platoon, because I could maintain the silent routine where other platoons who had nobody jungle trained failed. But it was absolutely brilliant, especially that my platoon was 74 strong, where the normal rifle platoon was only 30 strong. So we were able to do more adventurous types of exercises. And it was good because you also came across the Maasai. trying to dig water out of the dry riverbeds with tin cans and things like that. Of course, we were all carrying shovels on our backs. So we would ask them just to stand out the way, and then we would dig a great big trench for them till the water starts seeping through. So we were learning off them at the same time, because they would point out where the water was. It just depended how deep it was down. Sometimes you'd have to dig 10 feet down. But once the water came up, we would fill our water bottles, and the Maasai would fetch their sheep and the goats in, and the water was theirs then.
So a little bit of heart and mind, in a way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we used to give them rations. And there was occasions, because everything over there is red sand and soil. And when the monsoon parts come, it would wash the tracks out. And Bedford would, the Bedford trucks would either bog down or slide off the tracks. And it's there was more than one occasion where the Maasai would come with their spears and sticks and everything else and dig them out. And the only way the soldiers could say thank you would be to give them any food that they were carrying and any fresh water. And of course they were appreciative. But without asking, they would come and dig the trucks out and push you back onto the road.
Your platoon, with its firing techniques, etc., you would have to be careful where how and where you could fire in a jungle situation, surely.
We didn't take our anti-tank missiles with us. We went with our small arms, the weapons and the machine guns, although the mortars took theirs. And they had a brilliant area because there was also an artillery range over there, so the mortars could go with the artillery and they could fire all their systems. But we didn't fire our anti-tank systems. We more or less took the role on as a rifle company. We were just a big rifle company.
How long were you in there?
6 weeks. 6 weeks training, and there was a few days of travel in and a few days of travel back out. But the opportunity to train in Kenya was absolutely fantastic.
Then you'd return to England after 6 weeks?
Yeah, well, after the 6 weeks, yeah, we came back. We came back briefly back to Wheaton. But while we've still been in Kenya, of course, the band and bugles also came with us, and they would entertain the local dignitaries and different tribes, if you want, in different areas of Kenya. And they also played to the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, who were on a state visit to Kenya when we were there. But anyway, we came back to Wheaton, and of course D Company, remember, who'd got the Falklands 4 months earlier, they were just coming back that week as well. So for the first time in 4 months, the whole battalion were back together, very briefly, because in the November-December time, we were sent down to Green and Common, where, as you know, there was a great deal of unrest with the anti-nuclear demonstrators, who were mostly women, living under tents and polythene bags and all kinds. And for us at the same time, the COs were changing, because through Kenya we'd had Colonel Drew Drury, and now it was changing to Colonel Colin Keir, who'd actually been my company commander in Lemgo days and in a couple of the Northern Ireland tours in the 72 and 73 time. So here he is now as our commanding officer. So off we'd gone off to the United States Air Force Base at Green and Common, where they had the missiles, the nuclear missiles. And we spent some very wet weeks, cold weeks, having just come out of the jungle. Here we are back in Green and Common, soaking wet, freezing cold, protecting the Americans and the nuclear Air Force base.
What things were you dealing with there?
Mostly it was the women and the anti-nuclear protesters on the outside of the wire. Because we had a strange room, and we were living in 160-pound tents. We were all under canvas on the airfield. And all the abuse was coming from these hundreds of women outside the fence who had this strange thing about knitting patterns through our fence. While they were doing that, that wasn't a problem. The problem was when they were trying to cut through the fence, and did on occasions, to break through to get into the base. But there was two lots of strands of barbed wire, and we used to patrol inside the barbed wire. But we also had sentry boxes, like a prisoner of war camp, with searchlights on, going up and down the wire all the time. If the women did get in, or they were climbing the fence, we were supposed to get the civilian police or the MOD police to make any arrests. But we had to contain them, whichever segment or sector we caught them. Our job was to locate them and capture them, but we never touched them. It was all handed over to the civilian police, the MOD police, or the United States Air Force police.
Well, that's a very sensitive role, really. I mean, what do you do with a woman who doesn't want to be caught?
Well, that was it. But it was the abuse and the swearing, and they were terrible. Yeah, and it's not a situation for soldiers, which we were lucky. Like I say, we'd immediately get the civilian police in to do any arrests, so we weren't bogged down in trials at later dates. We would give our evidence, hand them over to the police, and then any civilian trials were done by the civilian police. But it was nearing Christmas, and of course, we were living on a canvas in marquees for the cook houses, and the quartermaster put a marvellous Christmas dinner on for the whole battalion, including the rum and everything else, because we thought we were there for Christmas. But luckily enough, we did our 5 or 6 weeks, whatever it was, and we were flown out by Hercules aircraft, having handed over to the Royal Artillery. So then, on Christmas Eve, so then poor guys had to spend Christmas there, and we were flown right back to an Air Force base right next to our married quarters.